With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
This week, we're taking a journey through the mysterious, miraculous world of blood with writer Rose George and her latest book, Nine Pints. Rose George is the author of A Life Removed, Hunting for Refuge in the Modern World, The Big Necessity, Adventures in the World of Human Waste, and Deep Sea and Foreign Going, Inside Shipping, the Invisible Industry that Brings You 90% of Everything, which we spoke about on a previous Little Atoms, and which was a BBC Radio 4 Book of the Week, and which won a Mountbatten Maritime Award. Rose writes frequently for The Guardian, New Statesman, and many other publications, and her two TED Talks on sanitation and seafaring have had 3 million views. And her latest book, Nine Pints, A Journey Through the Mysterious, Miraculous World of Blood, we're going to be talking about today. Rose, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Thank you very much.
What's the idea behind Nine Pints then?
Well, Nine Pints is roughly probably what I have in my body. Most the adult human is going to have, generally, the rough estimate is between 8 and 12 pints. So I assumed that I had about 9 pints. I haven't had my blood measured. You can volume measured, but you can do that. But I did, after I'd chosen the title, and I did speak to a haematologist who told me he'd seen my TED talk and he thought I was right. I probably had 9 pints. So that's the idea behind it.
So at the beginning of the book, though, you only have 8 pints, because the book starts with you going and donating blood. So to begin with, I want to talk about what the logistics are like if I wanted to go and donate blood in the UK.
They should be pretty straightforward. You can walk in. It's often quite difficult to do that, but you should be able to make an appointment, turn up to an appointment, then you'll fill in a questionnaire. You'll have been sent a letter, ideally. So you'll go in with your letter and then you'll fill in a questionnaire just asking you. It's a health screening, so you're supposed to be truthful. And once you've done that, you will go into a little room with a staff member and you will have your iron measured. So they'll prick your finger. They'll see if the blood sinks to the bottom to denote that you've got enough iron in your blood. They don't want people who are anemic giving blood. Obviously, that's not a good idea. So all these things are to ensure the safety of the blood supply. Then after that, you will go into the blood donating room. Actually, when the blood supply first started in sort of the Second World War, they used to call this the bleeding room, which I thought was that sort of suits my plain speaking Yorkshireness. But it's not called that anymore. It's the donating room. And you'll go and sit on a plastic chair, which is then, you'll go through other questions, your name, date of birth, and all that kind of stuff. And then you'll lie back and you'll proffer one of your arms. You get to choose which arm. And then you will hopefully lie back, squeeze a little ball to get the blood flowing, get a needle in your inner elbow, and give away hopefully about 400 millilitres or just under a pint of whole blood.
And donating is the key word here. In this country, they also call it a gift. It's basically voluntary. And there are places where you can go and sell your blood. There's an idea that voluntary is a better way of doing it. Why?
The World Health Organization emphasises its belief that the safest blood supply is what's called a voluntary, non-remunerated system. So that's what we have in the UK and have had since 1947, more or less. I mean, it's gone back a bit longer than 1947. And the reason for that is that if you're paying someone to sell blood, then it's probably someone who needs the money. it's going to become an income. And so that's going to be an incentive to probably sell blood more often than they probably should for their own health. And the other worry about blood selling is that you might be pushed to lie about your health so that you can get the money from your blood. Because obviously the burden is not on you to prove that your blood is safe. It then has to go and be processed. And so there's a cost to whichever system. I'm not sure of the statistics, but I think probably voluntary non-remunerated blood systems in the world are in the minority. I think around the world, for example, I visited India, where on paper, nobody sells blood in India, but in practice, you can go to any major hospital and it's often people running the stalls outside the hospital, and you can ask around and ask for a bag of B positive or A negative, and someone will then be fetched and the blood will be drawn and you will get a bag of it. And the reason for that is that India and many other countries around the world have something called a family replacement system, which is actually how blood banking got its name as well. So in the US, blood banking worked on a similar principle that if you required blood in surgery or any kind of medical procedure, you should repay that blood somehow. Obviously, you can't really give your own blood because you need it. So you would get it from a family member or a relative or just a really good friend who felt like giving you a unit of blood. And this is still how India's system works. But if you're, for example, India's a very mobile country, people move around a lot. So you'll often get migrants moving into cities alone. They don't have people to give blood for them. So obviously, in that kind of system, the obvious stopgap is selling blood. And there have been lots of cases of, for a start, you shouldn't really buy blood from anyone on a tea stall outside a hospital. But there have also been really bad cases of slavery, blood slavery, and people keeping other people prisoner and just really milking their blood for months on end. So yeah, we have the gold standard of blood supply in the UK. We're very fortunate.
The other thing to say is, of course, people have different blood types. And I, like most people, have no idea what my blood type
really
is. No.
Have you never given blood?
I haven't given blood. And certainly I have had procedures in the past. And I did a DNA test, which I imagine probably had my blood type on it at some point. But I've forgotten. Like, because it's, you know, I don't need to know on a regular daily basis. You know, I'm not about to give birth or anything like that. And then when I read in your book about blood types, it turns out the blood types are a lot more complicated than just your A and your B and your O, aren't they?
Yes. We think that there are four. If you ask the person on the street, first of all, if you ask what your blood type is, you're right, they probably won't know unless they've given birth or given blood, because you'll be told. And you're also right that you don't necessarily need to know, because if you have an accident, then there is what's called a universal blood, which is O negative, which can be given to anyone for lots of complicated reasons about blood groups and antigens, which I can go into if you like. But anyway, we think that there are four blood types or groups, which is A, B, O, and AB. And then there's the rhesus, which makes it positive or negative. So that's why you've got A positive, A negative. And the rhesus factor is, again, it's a complicated thing to do with the blood cell, but that gives you eight main groups. In fact, we think that given there are lots of rarer blood types, those are the most common, and there's probably about 300, or certainly more than eight, somewhere in between 8 and 300, and they're still being discovered. So blood is really rich and mysterious still, even though we think we do know a lot about it, but there's a lot more to be discovered. You haven't asked me, but mine is A positive. It's just really strange to me. You're right that there's no reason in a modern day world, in the UK, for example, if you had an accident, you would be given O negative blood. That would be in the rhesus room fridge. That's what you would be given. And then your blood would be matched, and then you would get a more precise blood given to you. I recite an anecdote in my book, which actually happened during the research of my last book. So it was on a quayside in Mombasa, and I was about to get on a Portuguese frigate to go and hunt pirates. But the Portuguese lieutenant who came to meet me, he had a name badge on, and it said his name was Pedro, and some long Portuguese name. And then underneath it said his blood type. I mean, of course it does, because we expect that in the military for people to have their blood types, because in the field, perhaps you might not have O negative, you might need to use a passing soldier, you might, you know, a walking blood bank, as they're called. But for some reason, this really struck me. And there was absolutely no logic or rationale to why I was surprised. I just thought, that's really intimate. I don't want to know his blood type. It felt like he was revealing something to me that should be kind of private. And maybe it was just really silly. So I just started questioning that, and I still haven't come up with an answer as to why I found that surprising, but I did.
You go to visit a leech farm facility in the book. Tell us about that visit, first of all, and then we'll talk some more about leeches.
Well, it's actually the leech farm facility in the UK, because there is only one. So the medicinal leech, I think many people would probably think that leeching is something out of Blackadder. I mean, there was a famous scene in Blackadder where he goes to the doctor to be cured of his love for his apparently male manservant. And the doctor prescribes leeches because the joke is everything, for every single ailment and condition, the answer is leeches. And that is true, that throughout up until about the 19th century, you know, bloodletting, using whatever method, leeches or scalpels or fleams or anything, that was standard. And I mean, bloodletting was so popular, it was used for severe blood loss. So it was seen as a magic cure. So I think, and certainly I did before I started reading into blood and leeches, I assumed that they were barbaric and certainly old-fashioned and certainly not used in modern medicine. And then so I was absolutely astonished to find that in one particular survey, they surveyed about 50 plastic surgery units, and I think 80% of those 50 were using leeches. So they're really commonly used.
What are they used for?
They're used because science still hasn't come up with an anticoagulant as good as a leech has. So if you stick a leech on you, and if it chooses to feed, it doesn't always choose to feed, it will bite into you and the blood will flow into the leech. But then the leech will drop off when it's full, but then the blood continues to flow. It has a really good anticoagulant. And when that's particularly useful is if, for example, where you've got lots of tiny, tiny blood vessels, capillaries, really tiny veins, and you're reattaching something. So, for example, if you've got a torn lip or a torn ear or a torn finger, or if you've women who've had mastectomies and have reconstructed breasts, sometimes they don't take, or you've had a skin flap reconstruction, sometimes it won't take, and what will happen is the blood will not start flowing because it's very difficult to connect really tiny blood vessels, even for highly skilled microsurgeons. And the blood will congeal and the reattached part will just not take and will drop off and you will have a failed reconstruction. So in many situations, they're also good for dog cauliflower ears, apparently. You stick a leech on and the leech will get the blood flowing better than the medical equivalent, which is actually a few leech compounds are used in medicine. But back to the leech farm. So the leech farm is a place called Biofarm and it's near Carmarthen in South Wales. I mean, it's a... it's in rolling parkland. It's just off, I can't remember which motorway. It's near a motorway, but then you drive off and then you get to this place, which is a really nice manor house and then some outbuildings which house the country's only leech farm. And it's a very, very successful establishment. It sends out packages of leeches all over the world. And so they breed two types of leeches. They breed a human medicinal leech, which is quite a small leech, which is apparently quite fussy about things like perfume and stubble. And then they breed another veterinary leech, which is the buffalo leech, which you usually find in certain parts of the world attached to cows' legs. And so they don't, and buffalo legs, obviously, that's why it's got its name. And they don't mind stubble and hair, so they're good for dogs and cats. And the reason I mentioned the buffalo leech is because when it came to the point where I was asked if I wanted to handle a leech, which of course I didn't, because who would? But there were some student nurses with us and they were all wonderful, going to be really good nurses. They probably are by now. And they were all absolutely enthusiastic about handling this leech. So I had to save face and handle the damn leech. And Carl, who was taking us round, I'm pretty sure that he did this deliberately, that he said he didn't have any of the smaller, less slimy medicinal leeches, the human, which are apparently not slimy at all. A lot of people think leeches are like slugs, but they're really not. They're an entirely different species, for example. They're worms, actually. But they're not supposed to be slimy. But the buffalo leech, which I did hold, and I don't remember what it felt like because I just apparently so disgusted. I remember it feeling really kind of cool and alive, and quite slimy because apparently they're the slimy ones, and I'm pretty sure that Carl did that deliberately. So the leech goes through the various tanks, various stages, and it's fed. You can feed a leech once a year or once every 6 months, and that will keep it going. And it's a very delicate process because you don't want big and small leeches in the same tank. So you don't want ones that have got sated and ones that haven't had enough, because then they'll just eat each other. So that's not a good idea. And then eventually they will become what is in effect a sterile hospital product. And they will be sent to a hospital. They will be put on a needy patient. And then apparently in the literature, when you read leeching papers, which I did for quite a long time, they're dispatched humanely. But when you actually look into it, there is a very, really wonderful nurse in Ireland who's written about leeching. And because it's always the nurses who persuade the patients to have them. It's not the surgeons. The surgeons just go in and say, right, you need leeches. And then it's the nurses who have to come in with the leeches and calm down their patients. But yeah, she told me what actually happens, which is that the leech is put in. So the natural lifespan of a leech is 27 years. But once they're 1 or 2 years old, they come out of, for example, biofarm, they get used in a hospital setting, and they are considered to be a biohazard because they're full of human blood. Or as Carl used to call them, a walking needle. And they do move. So leech migration is a huge problem. That you can apply a leech to a patient and then come back and find a leech up the shower curtain, in the next room, on the floor, under the bed, anywhere. And they are quick. They would beat a slug, probably. But yeah, so how they're dispatched is they're put in, I think it's alcohol, a special kind of alcohol, and they're basically exploded because they're full of blood. So it's really inhumane and I think really ungrateful. There was a lovely fellow in the 19th century called George Merriweather, who was a doctor in Whitby. Everything I've read of him, I think he would be a very nice man. He invented something called the Tempest Prognosticator. There's a copy of it in the Whitby Museum and I think one somewhere else. It was a barometer based on leeches. He was convinced that leeches could tell the weather, sense the weather. It didn't pan out because the actual barometer was invented around the same time and you didn't have to keep feeding leeches. So, but he was one of the few people who really valued the poor, humble leech, whereas mostly humanity has just used and abused it to the point of extinction, which is why they have to be bred.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Rose George. We're talking about her latest book, Nine Pints, A Journey Through the Mysterious, Miraculous World of Blood. And Rose, I want to move us on to, there's a woman I'd like you to talk about, Janet Vaughan. Who is she?
Janet Vaughan was she was principal of my college at Oxford, actually, before I was there. So I knew her. I lived in Vaughan, the building, which is actually my third name that no one could ever pronounce or spell before I went to Somerville College. And so I was really pleased that there was this woman called Vaughan who meant that everyone knew how to say my name. So I knew her as a name on a building, and I knew her as there was a portrait of her in the dining hall. And so, but I didn't think about her beyond that. And then I was reading, there's a very, very big, good book on blood from about 15 years ago by a guy called Douglas Starr. And it's mostly, you read through this book and it's mostly men. It's all, the history of blood is generally men, male doctors, male scientists, male, it's all men. But then there was this one reference to a woman called Janet Vaughan. Oh, that's odd. So I started looking into her, and so her story is astonishing. She was a haematologist. Well, she trained as a doctor. She was probably dyslexic, so she was considered too stupid to be educated. But eventually she got an education, and she went to Somerville College and got a first in, I think it was physical sciences, and she became a pathologist. But then with an interest in blood, and one of the first things she did was she understood that the current treatment for anemia at the time was to give people arsenic. And she thought that was probably not a very good idea, but it was the prevailing medical wisdom. But she'd read up on it, and she read that it was probably, it could work to give people liver. So she was very well connected, but not wealthy. Her cousin was Virginia Woolf. So when she decided to try raw liver extract for poor people suffering with anemia, it was a really big problem, for example, in the slums of London at the time. She went round and borrowed mincers from all her friends and relatives. So she sat in her kitchen with, amongst others, Virginia Woolf's mincer, and minced lots of raw liver, produced this extract, and was absolutely derided by her bosses at the hospital she was working at. She tried it on a dog, it got sick. She tried it on another dog, it got sick. So she thought, in what I learned was true Janet fashion, she thought she may as well take it herself. So she did. She got to hospital the next morning and found her entire department waiting on the lintel of the on the doorstep of the hospital, thinking she might be dead because they'd no idea. But anyway, it turned out to be the proper cure for anemia. So she figured it out. And of course, a male doctor took all the credit. But after that, as if that wasn't enough in one lifetime, she essentially was a fundamental part of setting up the modern blood supply as we have it. So she understood that coming up into the Second World War, at that time, there was blood donation and transfusion being performed, but it wasn't routine, and there was no kind of mass donation system. So there were volunteers organised by a guy called Percy Oliver through the British Red Cross, but it was still quite haphazard. But what Janet understood was, in wartime, it wasn't enough for a hospital to say, okay, we need blood, send a donor. That's how it usually worked. So she understood that blood had to be really separated from the donor and the recipient and stored, and that would be a much more efficient system. But in 1937, for example, at that point, there were lots of preparations for war. So lots of cardboard coffins were being made, trenches were being dug, railings were being taken down, people were being given gas masks, all sorts of things. But the entire supply of blood in emergency supply of blood in London was 8 pints. So Janet learned about this, thought it was ridiculous. And she knew that in the Spanish Civil War, there'd been a doctor who'd set up a really good blood supply. So she modelled herself on him, and she got her peers to come and sit in her living room in Bloomsbury, and they decided to set up a system of 4 blood supply depots around London. And of course, it was then taken on by the Medical Research Council, and Janet was given no credit in the report at the end of the war, but it was very, very successful. So she ran the depot in Slough with a bunch of lady drivers, including a couple of aristocrats who would drive in pearls. And they drove converted Wool's ice cream vans around London during the Blitz in blackouts, no lights, through the bombs, delivering blood all around the capital. And then came back to the depot at Slough, which Janet was very delighted had a bar so they could come back and have a whiskey. And she said that was essential to the functioning of a good blood supply depot, because people needed to let their hair down a little bit. But she was absolutely fundamental. And then, so without her, I don't think we'd have our modern blood supply.
I want to talk about plasma, and plasma being the clear liquid part of blood. We talked about blood donation as being, you know, mainly a voluntary thing. But of course, obviously, once the blood has been donated, it then does have a value. There is a sort of, obviously, an internal market for that blood. Plasma is particularly something that there is there's clearly a market for, isn't there?
Yes, there is. So particularly, I mean, in the UK, you can't sell your plasma. So the plasma that you donate, most female plasma is discarded because of a risk that if a woman has been pregnant, then there could be dangerous antibodies and people could react to it. It's quite complicated, and I'll probably get it wrong, so I'm just going to leave it at that. Female plasma is discarded in the UK. That plasma, so the male plasma that is produced, is used for transfusion usually. But plasma can have another purpose because it's full of really, really useful proteins. So plasma is also concentrated and refined into lots of medicinal products. And those medicinal products have a very, very high value. The plasma industry is worth at the moment, I think, about $17 billion. And the US is known as the OPEC of plasma and exports more plasma than any other country in the world. I think the next is China, mostly for these medicinal products. The reason it can do that and the reason it's become the OPEC of plasma is because in the US you're allowed to sell your plasma twice a week, which is it's pretty generous to let people sell plasma twice a week. And the research on what that does to someone's health is not quite clear. There are people who question the plasma industry in the US for two reasons. One reason is it's often people in low incomes. And if you look at many plasma clinics, they're often situated in low income areas along the border. For example, people do bus in from Mexico to come and sell their plasma, bus back home again. So it is an income. But the question is it good for your health to give that much plasma? You will generally regenerate plasma within 24 hours. But again, the long term effects of giving it that frequently are not really known. So that's one question as to whether it's a good idea to let people sell their plasma for $30 a pop. The other question is the history of the plasma industry. And in the UK, this should be in the minds of people at the moment, because the plasma, when people talk about contaminated blood and the infected blood inquiry that is ongoing, a public inquiry is now going on. And probably people remember that in the 1980s, lots of haemophiliacs, not just haemophiliacs, but principally haemophiliacs, were infected with HIV and hepatitis C from what's called contaminated blood. It was actually contaminated plasma, because plasma is a blood product. But for some reason, we now think of plasma and blood as almost separate things, and you can sell one but not the other. So those plasma products that infected people came from the US, almost certainly, and particularly from prisoners being given money for their plasma in various jails across the US. So it's a really, really ignoble and ugly history that plasma has. And of course, the plasma industry now says they're perfectly safe, that'll never happen again. And I'm sure they are doing the absolute utmost to make the plasma industry as safe as it can be, but you can never predict what next virus is going to come and what shape it's going to take and where it's going to come from. And because a plasma product is a pool of people's plasma, because within every donation there's a very tiny amount of useful stuff. So the problem is when you have one particular product called Factor VIII, which was what caused the tragedy, the criminal tragedy in the 1980s, one plasma product could be derived from 10,000 people. So if you think of the odds, they're not great. So there are people who do question whether plasma or a blood supply can ever be truly safe. And the answer is it's as safe as it can possibly be for now.
I want to finish off the interview talking about menstruation, I guess, in various different ways. But before we do that, can we talk about endometriosis, which is a condition that you have yourself? Mm-hmm. Tell us about what that is.
Well, there are various theories about what it is. That's not true. There are theories about what causes it. Endometriosis is when it's named after the endometrial lining of the womb, uterus, whatever you want to call it. And these endometrial cells end up elsewhere around the body. And the difficulty is they can stick organs together. So a lot of my organs are stuck together. They can attach themselves to nerve endings and give a lot of pain. I'm very lucky in that even though I have the most severe kind, mine must be in the right place, because I haven't really suffered a lot of pain from it. But it's probably made me infertile. So people don't really understand where it's come from. It's more and more common, whether that's because diagnosis is better, because diagnosis of endometriosis, like with many women's health issues, it takes far too long. On average, it's 10 years. And I think one of the principal problems is that women who go to the doctor, as I did as a teenager, and said, look, I've got really painful periods, it's seen as normal. Whereas there should become a point where if you're vomiting or lying curled up in a ball on the floor in pain, that's not normal and there should be investigation. But there wasn't in my case, and there still isn't in many girls and women's cases. So that's why that's one of the reasons endometriosis is increasing.
There's obviously lots of, still in the West, lots of taboos around menstruation. And then in the book, you visit Nepal, where women are literally put into huts while they menstruate. But in India, you meet a guy who's known as the menstrual man.
Menstrual man is a Tamil called, his short name is Muruga. He's got a nice long Tamil name. And his story is quite astonishing in that he was a poorly educated machine worker, married to a woman called Shanti. And one day Shanti came home and was hiding something behind her back, and he thought she was teasing. And eventually she pulled out, and it was rags that she'd been using as her sanitary pads, so bloodied rags. And he was shocked. He said, why don't you use sanitary pads? You can get them at the market. Why don't you use them? And she said, because we can't afford it, and it's either going to be milk or it's sanitary pads, and we need milk more than I need sanitary pads. And he was really struck by this. And although perhaps the reaction of many husbands in that situation would have been to, like, okay, that's women's business, you know, he thought that's not right. And so he spent the next 12 years developing a low-cost machine that could make low-cost sanitary pads, which was pretty much entirely manual. I think it needs to be plugged in, but operationally it's mostly manual. It can be operated by illiterate women. That's his ideal. And can produce whatever kind of sanitary pad is required. I mean, and that was at considerable cost to himself. His wife left him. The way he decided to explore how sanitary pads were made, because he didn't know, he assumed they were cotton, as a lot of people would. And so he got some cotton, and he decided that the best way to test it would be to wear it. So he made his own menstruation by getting a football, filling it with goat blood, and then putting a kind of pump on it, and then cycling around Coimbatore, where he's from, pumping every now and then to simulate a period, wearing these pads that he was wearing. And of course, he immediately learned what it's like to be a woman, because it's South India, it's hot. People wear white. He was wearing white. He was checking behind him for leaks and stains, which we've all done. You probably haven't, but we have. And learning essentially what it's like to have a period, and also learning that cotton was not what sanitary pads were made of. And eventually he figured out it was cellulose. It's compacted cellulose. And so he went on the way. His wife eventually came back. But although she's a very nice woman and made me a very, very nice lunch, it was only after he became well known that she came back. He was chased out of his village. They thought he was a vampire because he was asking young female medical students to give him their used sanitary pads to do research. So, yeah, quite an extraordinary story, which has actually now become a Bollywood film. It's been out a year or so, called Pad Man. And
they couldn't get away with Menstrual Man.
No, I recommend that you go and look at the trailer, because they've done it in, you know, that Hollywood baritone. It's in pure Hollywood baritone. Pad Man. I haven't seen it yet, but he's an amazing character. I do question, if he hadn't been a man, would he have got that much publicity? He probably wouldn't. There are lots of women doing really extraordinary things in trying to make the situation for women and girls a lot better, but he's the one who's had a Bollywood film named after him.
Just one more thing then. You mentioned that the villagers thought that Padman might be a vampire, and I want to finish off talking about this idea that I think is I can't remember his name, like the PayPal guy is supposedly into it. This thing where
Teal.
Rich old people are taking the blood of young people because it somehow has some sort of a rejuvenatory properties to it.
It's such a Twilight image, isn't it? It's such a great image. You can just see these Silicon Valley billionaires, I will name no names, allegedly, you know, biting into the necks of young, handsome men. Again, I'm sorry to disappoint everybody, but it's actually plasma, not blood. So there's no lovely, gory red blood involved. It's just going to be the yellow stuff again. But I know it happens because I interviewed the CEO of a company which does these plasma transfusions. Do they work? Who knows? I mean, it's all...
I mean, can we not be more specific than that? Surely this doesn't work. It's insane.
Well, I began to think it was insane when I was interviewing this guy, and he told me it could cure dementia, one donation of plasma. I mean, that's obviously nonsense. But there is serious research being done into these proteins in plasma that I mentioned before, and whether they can have a role in treating dementia and various other conditions. So there is definitely some scientific basis to this. Whether you are going to find, you know, an extra 10 years because you have a litre of plasma from a 23-year-old college student, probably not. But if you want to spend your money on that, go ahead.
So I've been talking to Rose George. We've been talking about her book Nine Pints, A Journey Through the Mysterious, Miraculous World of Blood, which is out now in the UK from Portobello Books. Rose, thank you so much for coming in and talking about it.
It's my pleasure.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP, and the podcast is hosted by Acast. Find us on iTunes, and if you like the show, please do leave us a review. You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our website littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.